Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 11th. Today's session is entitled Radical Literature, Radical Thinking, presented by Paul Olson, number OLP 2006-01. Let's listen in.
And so I think some of the things that we're going to do today are going to connect with what Bob's doing in the Bible study, what his wife Ellie is doing in hers, what April Johnson has done with racism and images of people of color or minorities or just apparently people in the Bible. So I'm just going to start kind of the wrong way for an image teacher. Typically, we look at a piece of literature and really be specific, and then go into, well, what is this saying in a larger context? I'm going to start the other way around. But with the Bible, and in particular with the Gospels, because the title of the session is, do writers inadvertently, whether they want to or not, somehow speak true to the Gospels? And to make the case, I'm going to write for you, I'll be your recording secretary, what are some of the major themes that run through the Gospels, the Gospels of the New Testament?
Forgiveness.
Okay, that's exactly the kind of stuff. Yep.
Love.
Repentance.
Patience.
What?
Patience.
Grace
and love.
I heard grace. Did I?
Yeah. We were thinking it.
You better be frightened because I can hear it.
Faith.
Kindness. Read your mind.
Kindness.
Kindness? Is that what you said? Is that right?
Kindness.
Healing.
Healing.
Judgment.
Judgment.
Faith.
Oh, you said that before and I didn't write it down.
That's all right.
I'll write it twice because I heard you, but
Made disciples.
Say again?
Made disciples.
Okay. We'll say just like you did. Make disciples?
I think as a counterpart to the patience one, there's also this urgency. There's things have to happen now.
That's a C. Yeah.
Embracing diversity.
Yeah. Thank you. And not just diversity, but embracing it.
Mm-hmm. New order.
And I'm going to add with that, just to have a word out there, inclusion, inclusiveness.
I think.
And what was I heard? Order.
New order.
Ooh, yeah.
I think you should put unconditional before the law, because that's something that was really a big message.
Keep thinking. Let me give you 10 more seconds.
One of the themes that we don't think about much these days, but saying it provocatively, intentionally, is anti-family. You have to reject your father and your mother.
Yeah, and I have a different word for that that I'm going to put down. I like your word better because it's mine is. Don't, if you ever use this on a test, I tell students if you put this word in a test, it's an automatic F. But I'm going to put it down anyway. A kind of an existential. That's why you don't want to use it. Stripping. And what I mean by that is this is your identity. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have you strip that. You know, love me more than your mother, father. Sell all you have. That's kind of that stripping that's there. But this is better. And we'll see why with the literature I'm going to do, too. Anything else? I'm seeing one word here we've got to get.
Hope. Salvation.
Hope.
Joy.
And salvation. For me, I got to put a question mark after whatever that means.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Redemption?
We have that out there, but no, we don't. Redemption, huge in literature. I heard a word that I've already forgotten.
Joy?
Hope?
Joy,
I said.
Could you put it for a little light?
Sure. Eternal life, and I'll underline life too, in question mark. Freedom? Liberation?
Yeah.
Well, the sword.
Another one you have to leave from last.
Yeah, well, right, all of them, for sure. Yeah.
There's a mandate, I've just broken my glasses, so I can't see very well. Mandate for ethical love your neighbor, and that I suppose is new word. There's a mandate. Do this, do that.
Okay, that's a moral, ethical, you didn't say moral, but ethical mandate, an ethical imperative. We got pretty well covered, or? We're going to cover all these now in 50 minutes.
Humility, or, the idea of, Jesus as servant and slave, and the parables about the small.
Yeah. That's a lot, and I would encourage Bible readers to sometimes I think we get that little chunk in church, right? And then we look at that, and we rarely step back and kind of, well, what is this whole thing about? I never heard before. Shame on me, but I heard Ellie's phrase that maybe the Bible is a whole book of conversation, and this and back and forth it all goes, and that's why, of course, we can't cover all this because there's a lot of conversation here. Okay. All that said, any other comments that you guys want to make? We don't have to stop this because I want to.
Food shows up a lot, but maybe that's
what?
Food shows up a lot.
Food.
Gathering together.
Yeah, that's really not what I'm going to cover, but but I'm going to write it down because you're my friend. And
perhaps breaking bread.
Yes.
Breaking bread.
Ooh, community and food. Actually, food is what I'm going to address. Okay. And there are, but we get the idea that there's a lot of stuff there, and there's some things that aren't there. And what I'm going to do is just read some different passages from kind of a variety of literature and see what you do with it. And I'm not out to prove, and if I left my first book, if no, I didn't. if I left it, where I was looking at this stuff. I'm not able to prove anything about this, but to raise the question, is it possible to kind of evangelize or preach or teach or render the truths of the gospel without intending to? And the first guy I chose was Per Lagerfeld, the Swedish writer, won the Nobel Prize in 1952. On his deathbed, when they asked him about faith and so on, he said, I would call myself a religious atheist. I have no idea what that means, but I've read all this stuff, and I think I maybe know. And we'll see what this is the opening for all of this. And what we have up here, then, I'm just going to tell Carol so she's with us. These are just themes that run in the Gospels. And you can add one if you want to. Okay. Here's how Per Lagerkvist, this Swedish writer, opens his, I think most people would say it too, his best book, Barabbas. Barabbas is a fictionalized, imaginative account of what it must have been like to be Barabbas, to be the guy for whom Jesus died, and that Jesus was substituted for. And this is the opening of that novel. Everyone knows how they hung there on the crosses and who they were that stood gathered around him. Mary, his mother, and Mary Magdalene, Veronica, Simon of Cyrene, who carried the cross, and Joseph of Arimathea, who shrouded him. But a little further down the slope, rather to one side, a man was standing with his eyes riveted on the dying man in the middle, watching his death throes from the first moment to the last. His name was Barabbas. This book is about him. I'm going to go on with it, but just anything about that strike you as strange, different, or does anything strike you?
Why is he there? Why in the world was he there?
Why? Great question. What the heck? I'm free. Get out of here. In fact, he asked the question himself. And that's a different thing that we'll go into. But this guy is compelled to see, you know, what is this that's gone? He's drawn there in a way that he can't understand. And, yeah, that's a good question. Anything else?
Struck me that it was in third person. I don't know whose voice it is yet.
Yeah, well, and that's a great point, too, about the whole novel. You never do. No quotations, and you never know if it's an omniscient narrator, if it's Barabbas himself, if it's somebody observing Barabbas, and they see this with another character. You never know. And another theme about that is, I think, is the kind of the slipperiness, the uncertainty of truth. I mean, whose perspective is this? And is it Barabbas? Is it the all-knowing? But that's another thing, too. I want to read this part of this again. These are the people that were there. Mary, the mother, and Mary Magdalene, Veronica, Simon of Cyrene, and Joseph of Arimathea. Everybody, do you know everybody there?
No.
Who don't you know?
Veronica.
Oh, yeah. So, where does she come from?
Catholic.
Okay, we're done. There were no Catholics at the crucifixion. So, what's going on in this writer's, just in this first picture of the crucifixion? Somebody tell us who Veronica is.
Isn't she the one who, as Jesus is walking toward the cross, hands him a cloth and dries his face?
Yes.
In the movie, the Passion, this is one of the characters in the Passion.
Yeah. Biblical character?
No.
And so some kind of traditional mythical character that gone through the Roman church. But she's there. So now talk to us about that.
I mean, there's people in there who aren't mentioned in the Bible as being at the cross per se.
Right.
I mean, they were, you know, along the way or later, but they weren't, you know.
Yeah. So we've got a little fictionalized account here, and Veronica really wasn't there. And so we're not taking a biblical model, are we? I mean, we've got a little bit of myth mixed in there. Go ahead, Randy.
Well, in one way or another, maybe every one of us has been there from time to time.
It could be. Maybe that's the door that the Lagerfist is opening, too. But for sure we know that as he started out, we've got a traditional picture of the crucifixion has been
altered.
Great word. Okay, we'll continue. He is Barabbas here. He was about 30, powerfully built with a sallow complexion, a reddish beard, and black hair. His eyebrows also were black, his eyes too deep set, as though they wanted to hide. Under one of them he had a deep scar that was lost to sight in his beard. But a man's appearance is of little consequence. Remember that line. And here's how he describes Jesus, Lagerfist, the writer. And we have this couple paragraphs saying Barabbas can't figure out why he's there, what's compelled him to be there. But the crucified man's head hung down and he was breathing heavily. It would not be long now. There was nothing vigorous about the fellow. His body was lean and spindly, the arms slender as though they had never been put to any use. A queer man, the beard was sparse and the chest quite hairless, like a boy's. He did not like him. You do that. You're Jesus? Up in Rockford, Illinois? And who's it? Is it Solomonson? Is that the guy? He's got this sweet, he's got this painting of Jesus on his knees.
Solomon,
yeah.
But doesn't that contradict the previous notion that appearance doesn't matter?
Well, doesn't it? But how are we as readers feeling about this whole scene? That ain't my Jesus, is it? Spindly? Queer man? Beard is sparse and his chest is hairless and how many images of Jesus like that have you seen? Typically, go ahead.
But when you think of the art, when you see him depicted in the art, he might have the beard and stuff, but he doesn't.
The art.
He is the traditional, you know, traditional.
You're right.
Less,
some like, art.
European.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's Richard Hook?
He was closer to my image.
To your image. And so what is your image?
My image is that recreation that I think it was National Geographic did a few years back in a PBS special. Mm-hmm. Rather dark-skinned and dark, quite hairy, and kind of heavy-set and rugged-looking.
Well, okay, what's Hollywood's image? What has it been in all the movies from The Rope to Quo Vadis to...
Long hair, gorgeous.
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 Beautiful.
Blue eyes, pretty much.
Did Jimmy Beasel have blue eyes?
I don't know. That was in...
I think he had brown eyes.
The Passion. Passion.
Yeah. Except, who was the movie where they didn't show his face?
Well, what do you think? Okay, we can talk about this all day, but what do you think?
None of the depictions seem odd, though. When you see the depiction of Jesus, you don't think that's odd. Right.
That's odd. Yeah. Does this seem odd? This is odd.
I don't know.
This is more like...
You're screwing up the whole presentation.
But spindly is a negative adjective.
Yeah.
And to throw in negative adjectives about Jesus, it's like...
His arms have never been put to any use.
Yeah. This is like an El Greco painting.
Yeah. So, that's all I'm going to read out of this. What is...
I guess the arms never put to any use is kind of contradictory to my thoughts. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Is a man's appearance of any consequence?
No.
Obviously.
We're a little bit undone by this, you know, I don't know if that's my Jesus. And we have these pictures and we have these traditional... So what's the writer trying to do? This religious atheist, he calls himself.
Wrench you.
From... Wrench you from out of...
Complacency.
Complacency?
Tradition.
What?
Tradition.
Tradition? Can we go so far as to say idolatry? What are we... Follow. What are we? This has got to be my. Yeah. So, on one hand, if we had a bigger board, we have images of God and images of some of these themes as well. And we begin to, Lagerfest, I think, is setting us up for what is it we look for to find truth? What is it that we expect? And as soon as we have something that we're sure of, it's gone. The whole book is about that. Okay, we'll move away from that. Completely different stuff. And again, the question is, how do poets and fiction writers, artists, stay true to the gospel? This is a little bit long. It'll take about 4 minutes, but I think you'll stay with it because it's a real accessible poem. It's called To a Siberian Woodsman. It's by Wendell Berry. And the context of his writing this was he's been looking through a photograph book of Siberian or Russian peasants during the time of the Cold War. And he addresses, he's seen all these pictures now, and I'll set you up for one of the big lines in there when he says, "How can they consider your death negligible now that I've seen pictures of your face?" But it's about, well, you'll see. I'll just set you up though this way. He first imagines this, he's seen this Siberian woodsman, that's all he's seen. And then he imagines him in his house with his kids growing up, and then compares them with his own kids here in Kentucky. Well, here it goes. "You lean at ease in your warm house at night after supper, listening to your daughter play the accordion. You smile with the pleasure of a man confident in his hands, resting after a day of long labor in the forest. The cry of the saw in your head, and the vision of coming home to rest. Your daughter's face is clear in the joy of hearing her own music. Her fingers live on the keys like people familiar with the land they were born in. You sit at the dinner table late into the night with your son, tying the bright flies that will lead you along the forest streams. Over you, as your hands work, is the dream of the still pools. Over you is the dream of your silence while the east brightens, birds waking close by you in the trees. I have thought of you, stepping out of your doorway at dawn, your son in your tracks. You go in under the overarching green branches of the forest, whose ways, strange to me, are well known to you as the sound of your own voice, or the silence that lies around you now that you have ceased to speak. And soon the voice of the stream rises ahead of you, and you take the path beside it. I have thought of you, I have thought of the sun breaking pale through the mists over you as you come to the pool where you will fish, and of the mist drifting over the water, and of the cast fly resting light in the face of the pool. And I am here in Kentucky, in the place I have made myself in the world. I sit on my porch above the river that flows muddy and slow along the feet of the trees. I hear the voices of the wren and the yellow-throated warbler whose songs pass near the windows and over the roof. In my house, my daughter learns the womanhood of her mother. My son is at play, pretending to be the man he believes I am. I am the outbreathing of this ground. My words are its words, as the wren's song is its song. Who has invented our enmity? Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? Who has armed us against each other with the death of the world? Who has appointed me such anger that I should desire the burning of your house or the destruction of your children? Who has appointed such anger to you? Who has set loose the thought that we should oppose each other with the ruin of forests and rivers and the silence of birds? Who has said to us that the voices of my land shall be strange to you and the voices of your land strange to me? Who has imagined that I would destroy myself in order to destroy you, or that I could improve myself by destroying you? Who has imagined that your death could be negligible to me now that I have seen these pictures of your face? Who has imagined that I would not speak familiarly with you, or laugh with you, or visit in your house and go to work with you in the forest? And now, one of the ideas of my place will be that you would gladly talk and visit and work with me. I sit in the shade of the trees of the land I was born in. As they are native, I am native, and I hold to this place as carefully as they hold to it. I do not see the national flag flying from the staff of the sycamore, or any decree of the government written on the leaves of the walnut. Nor has the elm bowed before monuments or sworn the oath of allegiance. They have not declared to whom they stand in welcome. In the thought of you, I imagine myself free of the weapons and the official hates that I have borne on my back like a hump. And in the thought of myself, I imagine you free of weapons and official hates, so that if we should meet, we would not go by each other looking at the ground like slaves sullen under their burdens, but would stand clear in the gaze of each other. There is no government so worthy as your son who fishes with you in silence beside the forest pool. There is no national glory so comely as your daughter whose hands have learned the music and go their own way on the keys. There is no national glory so comely as my daughter who dances and sings and is the brightness of my house. There is no government so worthy as my son who laughs as he comes up the path from the river in the evening for joy. Themes. What have you heard that comes, that connects to what we all said that the gospel was?
Most of what's on the board. Sympathetic, liberating, salvific, hopeful, and definitely a new order.
Compared
to the legalistic order. He's humble. He's very unjudgmental. This overwhelming kindness of
good.
Michael Barry.
Good.
It's like Jesus talking.
Yeah.
Good. More.
Patience.
Yeah. What are we about?
It's about loving thy enemies and question if they really are your enemies.
Is that gospel?
Yeah.
Funny thing. Yeah. What else?
I think it's about idolatry.
The idolatry is what are the idols? America is really good at this right now, frankly.
Government.
Something that patriotism and struck me is that it doesn't name countries in the poem, and it's almost universal, and it can apply then, and it can apply now, and it can apply other places.
How is that done? I mean, we don't have to analyze the poem. That's not the point of this class. But you heard something about that, about sycamores and walnuts and elm trees. And
we'll talk about the banner flying at the elm tree.
Yeah. The elm tree is, what nationality is the elm tree? That's the point, isn't it?
Dutch.
Dutch, yeah. They all died.
It's like Jesus in the parable. He's using mundane things we know about.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. So, give me a word, your word, for all of this stuff, and then what you just heard there, too. I'm looking for any one specific word, but what we've got. I guess I am. I'll hit you a direction. We're kind of looking at a different paradigm. We're looking at the world differently. I would sure say that one of my favorite lines, and I think some of you heard me say it,
Maya Angelou says, we survive in the exact relationship to the dedication of our poets. And I'm calling, as she would too, she doesn't, but she would. The poets are the prophets, the same way the biblical prophets who tell us this is who you are.
I think Luther says that Christians are people who call things by their proper name.
Yeah, I love that. That's a good point.
That, it seems to me that that's what the Gospels do and that's what Barry does. Things by their proper name.
The national state. You know, what does Jesus say about, you know, we know all the parables and the Good Samaritan and the Samaritans at the well and all the people that are, and Jonah has to take off to save the Assyrians, the biggest enemy of all. It's not just in the New Testament, but we're sticking to the Gospels. Things by their proper name.
So we have missiles, we call them peacemakers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's true of a sort.
Anything else? Just general words about what you're connecting to. I'm going to give you mine, and it surely is. This is radical stuff. This is revolutionary. I was put revolutionary stuff. And I kind of wonder when I look back at whether it's John Milton in the 17th century, or Shakespeare in the 16th century, or it's, I'm going to read for a second, Nikki Giovanni in the 20th century, if all the great poets aren't radical. Revolutionary. If they all aren't as radical as, I mean, this stuff is pretty radical. I mean, if Jesus isn't anti-institutional, what is he? I mean, he's in love. But, okay. Here's one that might be a little
first.
What?
That one wasn't anti-family at all. It was very focused on the love of family and the good in family. So that's kind of I mean, not that Jesus never would have, you know, commented on that also, but it doesn't go along with our theme of anti-family.
Well,
it's a different story.
I qualify that too, not to disagree with my friend and colleague, but anti-family, that sure has to be qualified. He did, in fact, as he offered, love me more.
Because that's what...
certain politicians don't send their kids to war.
Yeah. But the overwhelming thing that I get from that is the love of his own family and not wanting to destroy that for somebody else either.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it has that base image at it.
And yet,
what does
the state very come along and say, though? Be loyal to me as the fatherland, if we use that language even.
Yeah.
Loyal enough to go kill your own, to send your own son.
Yeah. And that's a great, you've tied it together there, the whole notion that we will send our men off, and women too, off to war. And isn't it kind of crazy? Well, here's another, what am I doing? The 1960s and 70s, early 70s, were full of what the world, the American poetic world, called revolutionary black poets. And one of my fields for my study has been African-American literature, this little white Norwegian from Minnesota. And the first formal class I ever had was in grad school, and it was taught by a revolutionary black poet. And this is the poem he read to me. And I want you, just for a second while I read it to you, imagine this little Norwegian Minnesotan slipping further down in the desk saying, I don't want to hear anymore. But it's gospel, I think. Yusef Iman called Love Your Enemy. Brought here in slave ships and pitched overboard, love your enemy. Language taken away, culture taken away, love your enemy. Work from sunup to sundown, love your enemy. Last hired, first fired, love your enemy. Rape your mother, love your enemy. Lynch your father, love your enemy. Bomb your churches, love your enemy. Kill your children, love your enemy. Forced to fight his wars, love your enemy. Pay the highest rent, love your enemy. Sell your rotten food, love your enemy. Forced to live in the slums, love your enemy. Dilapidated schools, love your enemy. Puts you in jail, love your enemy. Bitten by dogs, love your enemy. Water hose you down, love your enemy. Love, 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 love. Love for everybody else, but when will we love ourselves? What do you hear? I mean, with all the historical references you get, I'm sure, right? We ripped them out of the land. Okay. Those are easy. Here's the second one I heard. Actually, this is the first one that I'm going to read now. This is the one that made me slide down in my chair. The word nigger is used, and I, when I do this in classes at Augustana, I don't do this poem very often, I probably haven't for 20 years, but they know who I am and where I'm coming from and what I do in life. You guys don't, and so in some cases this could be offensive. George Bush has ruined the idea, trust me, but trust me. Nigger, can you kill? Can you kill? Can a nigger kill? Can a nigger kill a honky? Can a nigger kill a man? Can you kill a nigger? Huh? Nigger, can you kill? Do you know how to draw blood? Can you poison? Can you stab a Jew? Can you kill? Huh, nigger? Can you kill? Can you run a Protestant down with their 68 Eldorado? That's all they're good for anyway. Can you kill? Can you piss on a blonde head? Can you cut it off? Can you kill? A nigger can die. We ain't got to prove we can die. We got to prove we can kill. They sent us to kill Japan and Africa. We policed Europe. Can you kill? Can you kill a white man? Can you kill a nigger in you? Can you make your nigger mind die? Can you kill your nigger mind and free your black hands to strangle? Can you kill? Can a nigger kill? Can you shoot straight and fire for good measure? Can you splatter their brains in the street? Can you kill them? Can you lure them to bed to kill them? We kill in Vietnam for them. We kill for UN and NATO, NATO and CETO and US and everywhere for all alphabet but B-L-A-C-K. Can we learn to kill white for black? Learn to kill niggers? Learn to be black men? How is that gospel? Maybe it isn't. I don't know. What?
It speaks to a kind of redemption and liberation.
Ooh.
That might not be the same as the redemption and liberation we see in the Gospels.
I think that Jesus was very critical on the idolatry of his time and our idolatry of our time of death and killing. Our way of getting what we want is by loving death and killing the other.
We know we can kill. It's a pretty radical thought, isn't it? Can you love? Can you kill? In the 1970s, there was a book called Student as Nigger. And it expanded that whole idea of the nigger mind, the slave word, into we can all be, the guy's is a black guy, universalizing the word, that we can all be slaves. And I'll use that word instead. We can all be niggers tied to this image of this is what we are, this is what we're going to do, we're going to do this way. Can you kill that? Can you strip that away from your whole vision of life and live a different way? I'm not going to your war. I mean, who did that? Pretty famous guy.
Muhammad.
Yeah, Muhammad Ali. So I'm not going. And they throw him in jail. Why do all these guys like Lew Alcindor and Cassius Clay change their names? We're going to strip this like, love me more than your mother. I guess the phrase that rings to me out of that is sell all you have, even your name. Sell your mind that has you thinking, can you kill this? And there's a kind of spiritual violence that comes out of this physical violence that's present. Excuse me. One easier to listen to, okay? Anybody else? More comments about that? That's a pretty radical poem, and you can see where it would frighten this little white kid from Minnesota saying, whoa! But it changed my life. I'll read it something else to it. I never thought of this till right now. I was done with a master's degree in American literature. And I was sitting in a class, this class where this black poet read. I just took it because, wow, I didn't see this guy's coming to the University of Oregon. This is cool. And I just took the class on a whim. And I was sitting by my best friend at that time was a black man just finishing his, we're in the same classes, finishing his master's degree too. And the teacher referred to Richard Wright. Who knows who Richard Wright is? Everybody, right? African-American, native son, black, white, okay. I turned to my friend and said, who's Richard Wright? Now, I had been educated at a good four-year liberal arts institution and the University of Minnesota and the University of Oregon, and I had never heard of Richard Wright. Now, maybe that's my fault, but I'm suggesting to you that that's a kind of institutional racism that says, this is the canon, this is the stuff. To have a master's degree in English, you better know this stuff. You don't have to know who Richard Wright is and you know, all those others. And there's a kind of stripping away of that idea of a canon, or these are the things that you got to know, and say, maybe you should know these other things too. So that's this revolutionary thought of even how we begin to walk in other artists' or poets' shoes, other than you know the Keats and the Shelleys and the Frosts and this, you know, you can name them, all the guys that probably most of us study. When I my first year at Holden, I went to every
anthology. You know how their library is, it's a wonderful library, but it has faults because lots of books just come from people who leave them. I grabbed every poetry anthology of American literature in the library and looked for black writers, not one. Now, but they have some old anthologies. The anthologies have changed. The point is there that this is kind of a radical, a different look at how we, what we think is important and what we value. And yeah, you're just stretching there.
No, look at the list of things though, that we have on the board, and think about how violent that. I'm segueing to my own stuff that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I think how violent that poem is, and we want to affirm that poem, but it makes our list look pretty white,
yeah,
pretty pale in comparison. Where's that kind of edge in kindness and grace and patience? And I'm not saying those things can't be edgy, but there's some other piece that isn't on that board. It's in that poem.
Yeah, right. Maybe we're going to put it up here since you said it. I would love to engage, not here, but anybody in a discussion. That my own sense of that is that the violence required to make this stuff live isn't physical. It's a spiritual kind of violence that says, you know what? You know, maybe, just to be concrete and in a flippant kind of illustration, you know, maybe the best illustration of the depression in America isn't John Steinbeck's, this white guy's Grapes of Wrath. Maybe it's Richard Wright's Native Son. And I got to rip that whole vision away. That's kind of a violent process of, you know, who are the best writers? Well, if you grew up and went on to grad school and kept going and you'd read all these definitions of, you know, what this is what poetry is, the definitions I learned before I got into African American literature wouldn't even call that a poem. That is not poetry. And so, well, then that vision gets ripped away too. And that, I think there's something about a spiritual kind of violence that's there that doesn't require, I got to shoot you with a gun. And here's proof. Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. Who cares, but my favorite character in all of American literature is Pilate Dead, the protagonist, the hero, the main character of this book. And I got to look at my note to see what pages I set up to read first. Pilate, let's see here. Here are the characters you need to know as you listen to this. Pilate, Dead is her last name, and she's got a brother named Macon. And Macon has a son nicknamed Milkman. And Milkman has a friend named Guitar. Pilate never got married, but she had a daughter named Reba. And Reba never got married and had a daughter named Hagar. None of that really, it matters to us, really. We'll just make what I'm doing here clear.
You wouldn't call Milkman if you hadn't listened to this one?
You could. I wouldn't, yeah. God, I hate it when kids know more than I do. That's great. I think that's legit. That you could call Milkman.
I mean, Pilate is definitely...
Yeah. Yeah. You get A. That's good.
Yeah.
See me about an application, Augustine. I said
that.
Yeah. We got that kid who's going to claim a scholarship. Pilate, and I'll read about her in a second, is a pretty revolutionary character. In literature, sometimes they call characters like Pilate Christ figures. I'll let you decide that as you read just the small lecture. Here's the small lectures I'm going to read. Macon clearly is not a Christ figure, and Macon's her brother, and here are Macon's values. Macon says to his son, after he's told his son Milkman, to stay away from my sister. But she's too screwed up. I don't want you even near her. You can't go over to her house. Boy, you got better things to do with your time than go over to Pilate's. Besides, it's time you started learning how to work. You start Monday. After school, come to my office. Work a couple of hours there and learn what's real. Pilate can't teach you a thing you can use in this world. Maybe the next, but not this one. Let me tell you right now, the one important thing you'll ever need to know, own things. And let the things you own other things. Then you'll own yourself and other people too, and starting Monday, I want to teach you how. Pilate, your friend? Macon? want to live with that? You get the point. Macon, and by the way, the symbol of Macon's life is that he carries this ring of keys on his belt. And that's what he's most proud of, because he owns his property and he got keys to all his property. Well, then we meet Pilate. And, you know, those of you who are parents, tell your kids not to do it. Guess what? Don't go to Pilate. Think what no man does. He goes to Pilate, of course. He's heard all these rumors about her. Pilate, by the way, and I guess that's germane, I don't know if it is to us, but I'll tell you. She's ostracized from all sense of community and individual relationships because she has no navel. And it just popped away, and she's got a bare belly. And of course, that's impossible. This is fiction. But it's imaginative fiction, and she's ostracized for kind of a silly reason. You know, it's one reason to ostracize you because, you know, well, you get the point. Why would anybody care? But because of that, they've got all these rumors circle about her. All those unbelievable but entirely possible stories about his father's sister, the woman his father had forbidden him to go near, had both of them, that is, the milkman and guitar, the two boys, had both of them spellbound. Neither wished to live one more day without finding out the truth, and they believed they were the legitimate and natural ones to do so. After all, Guitar already knew her, and Milkman was her nephew. They found her on the front steps, sitting wide-legged in a long-sleeved, long-skirted black dress. Her hair was wrapped in black, too, and from a distance, all they could really see beneath her face was the bright orange she was peeling. She was all angles, he remembered later, knees mostly, and elbows, one foot pointed east and one pointed west. As they came closer and saw the brass box dangling from her ear, Milkman knew that what with the earring, the orange, and the angled black cloth, nothing, not the wisdom of his father nor the caution of the world, could keep him from her. Guitar, being older and already in high school, had none of the reluctance that his young buddy still struggled with, and was the first one to speak. "Hi." The woman looked up, first at Guitar and then at Milkman. "What kind of a word is that?" Her voice was light, but gravel-sprinkled. Milkman kept on staring at her fingers, manipulating the orange. Guitar grinned and shrugged. "It means hello. Then say what you mean." "Okay, hello. That's better. What you want?" "Nothing, we just passing by." "Looks to me like you standing by." "If you don't want us here, Miss Pilate, we'll go," Guitar spoke softly. "I ain't the one that wants. You the one wants something." "We want to ask you something." Guitar stopped feigning indifference. She was too direct, and to keep up with her, he had to pay careful attention to his language. "Ask it. Somebody said you ain't got no navel." "That the question?" "Yes." "Don't sound like a question. Sound like an answer. Give me the question." "Do you?" "Do I what?" "Do you have a navel?" "No." "What happened to it?" "Beats me." She dropped the bright peeling into her lap and separated an orange section slowly. "Now do I get to ask a question?"
"Sure."
"Who's your little friend?" Now she knows who her nephew is, and it's a long story. Even on 37 pages, you already know that he wouldn't even be alive if it weren't for Pilate. "Who's your little friend?" "This here's Milkman." "Do we talk?" I mean, she wanted to talk to him. "Do we talk?" "Say something." "Do we talk?" Pilate swallowed a piece of the fruit. "Yeah, he talk." "Say something." Guitar shoved an elbow at Milkman without taking his eyes off Pilate. Milkman took a breath, held it, and said, "Hi." What he's not supposed to say. Pilate laughed. "You must all be the dumbest unhung Negroes on earth. What are they telling you in that school? You say hi to pigs and sheep when you want them to move. When you tell a human being hi, he ought to get up and knock you down." Shame had flooded him. He had expected to feel it, but not that kind. To be embarrassed, yes, but not that way. She was the one who was ugly, dirty, poor, and drunk. The queer aunt whom his sixth-grade schoolmates teased him about, and whom he hated because he felt personally responsible for her ugliness, her poverty, her dirt, and her wine. But instead, she was making fun of his school, of his teachers, of him. And while she looked as poor as everyone said she was, something was missing from her eyes that should have confirmed it. Nor was she dirty. Unkempt, yes, but not dirty. The whites of her fingernails were like ivory, and unless he knew absolutely nothing, this woman was definitely not drunk. Of course, she was anything but pretty, yet he knew he could have watched her all day, the fingers pulling thread veins from the orange sections, the berry black lips that made her look as though she wore makeup, the earring, And when she stood up, he all but gasped. She was as tall as his father, head and shoulders taller than himself. Her dress wasn't as long as he had thought. It came to just below her calf. And now he could see her unlaced men's shoes and the silvery brown skin of her ankles. So we're going to go on. What do you make of Pilate so far?
Real Christ figure. Radically honest. Present in the moment. Very present.
Yeah. They're good answers. Present in the moment. Brutally honest. Okay. She has this... and she's more than just this radical dresser. She has a radical vision of life. And here's really one of the great scenes of imagination. I have to tell you that I have a tendency to say that about a lot of scenes. I like a lot of books. I say, this is the best scene in American literature. The next day I say, no, this is the best scene in American literature. There are about 492 best scenes in American literature. Here's one of those 492. She's telling about when she and her brother, when they got along and they lived together, they were best friends. And she's telling about the time she was lost out in the woods. Now, we lost, and there was this wind in front of us with the back of our daddy. We were some scared children. Megan kept telling me that the things we were scared of wasn't real. Well, what difference do it make if the thing you're scared of is real or not? I remember doing laundry for a man and his wife once down in Virginia. The husband came into the kitchen one afternoon shivering and saying, did I have any coffee made? I asked him, what was it that had grabbed hold of him? He looked so bad. He said he couldn't figure it out. But he felt like he was about to fall off a cliff. Standing right there on that yellow and white and red linoleum as level as a flat iron. He was holding on to the door first, then the chair, trying his best not to fall down. I opened my mouth to tell him, wasn't no cliff in that kitchen. And then I remembered how it was being in those woods. I felt it all over again. Remember in the woods, she was afraid, remember, were with me? The brother said, it's not real. And so she said, it's not real, but then she remembered, okay, just so you got that part. Then I remembered how it was being in those woods. I felt it all over again. So I told the man that he wanted me to hold on to him so he couldn't fall. He looked at me with the most grateful look in the world. Would you? He said. I walked around back of him and locked my fingers in front of his chest and held on to him. His heart was kicking under his vest like a mule in heat. But little by little, it calmed down. You saved his life, said Qatar. No such thing. His wife came in before it was time to let go. She asked me what I was doing, and I told her. Told her what? What'd you say? The truth. That I was trying to keep him from falling off a cliff. I bet he wished he had jumped off then. She believed you? Don't tell me she believed you. Not right away she didn't. But as soon as I let go, he fell dead weight to the floor. Smashed his glasses and everything. Fell right on his face. And you know what? He went down so slow. I swear it took 3 minutes. 3 whole minutes to go from a standing upright position to when he mashed his face on the floor. I don't know if the cliff was real or not, but it took him 3 minutes to fall down it. Was he dead? Asked Qatar. Stone dead. What do you do with that?
Thank God it's fiction.
Yeah. But it's got a great truth to it. This is impossible. Let's everybody stand up and try it. No. Who's my lawyer? 3 minutes to fall down.
Why?
Sure.
Perception.
Poetic license. Perception into... This is a whole new way to look at them. I mean, his wife, right, says, here's this woman standing with her arms around this guy. What are you doing? I'm keeping him from falling off a cliff. Yeah, right there on the lonely, the yellow, red, and white linoleum floor. Don't give me that. This guy... Well, I don't know if this connects to this for me, to Bob's notion about violence, and that if we can only use our imagination, maybe there are other ways to, and somehow, I was going to tell him the real truth. This is not, there is no cliff. But then I thought for a minute. You've all heard it, right? How can I help you? Can I hold you? Oh, would you? It's crazy. It's fiction. But it is a whole other, what's the word? Paradigm? A whole other way to look at the world and say, I can save this guy. And the woman, his wife, has no imagination, can see things only in the reality that's there, and he falls over and dies. Yeah.
Well, this is kind of a bad pop culture reference, but it's kind of similar to the idea of the Matrix, in that if you die in your mind, that you die in real life, and I wonder if that's possible.
Oh, every poet I know would say, and they have a phrase for it in literary criticism, is it's life in, or death in life. You know, you're really alive. Who's really alive? I mean, Jesus talks about that a lot, doesn't he?
Let the dead bury their dead.
What?
Let the dead bury their dead.
Yeah. So, the whole notion of the spiritual life versus the physical. Yeah, a lot of us are walking around the world, but are we really alive? And do we see the sunset and,
is there a line when she says, I remember, in that part, I remember being in the woods?
She does. That's what triggers her.
Yeah. Yep. So she's going into her own experience to bring it to bear.
Yeah. And how can that's how it causes her to identify with his fear. I remember that. And what she was afraid of in the woods wasn't real either. But it was... The point is, no matter... It's fiction. But the point is, it's another reality. So is the world, Barack Obama is talking about, and so did George Kucinich, I think, in the presidential races, starting a Department of, anybody know? Instead of the Secretary of War, we're going to have a Secretary of... Ooh, is that a different idea or what? Mm-hmm. The point is simply that, that's an imaginative look. It doesn't even cross our mind to think of a Secretary of Peace. We've got a whole industrial revolution or a whole industrial complex that makes us think of secretaries of war. And, okay, well, Pilate goes further, and this is we got 5 minutes. We got to cover this. Hagar, now the milkman and guitar are still talking with Pilate, and in walks Hagar and Reba. This is very short. Hagar, Pilate looked around the room. This here's your brother, milkman. And this is his friend. What's your name again, pretty? Guitar. Now, is Milkman her brother? No. Milkman is her
third cousin.
Cousins, yeah, right. Okay, not her brother, though. What's your name again, pretty? Guitar. Guitar. You play any? That ain't her brother, Mama. They cousins, Reba said. Same thing. No, it ain't, is it, baby? No, said Hagar, it's different. See there, it's different. That's Reba and Hagar agreeing with each other, saying, come on, Pilate, you're wrong. It's not your brother. Well, what is the difference, Reba? You know so much, says Pilate. Reba looked at the ceiling. A brother is a brother if you both got the same mother or if you both, Pilate interrupted her. I mean, what's the difference in the way you act toward him? Don't you have to act the same way to both? That's not the point, Mama. But it is, sure. And you have here unconditional love, and it's my brother. Don't you have to act the same way? And is that gospel? I don't know. But it rings. Don't you have to act the same way to both? The Siberian woodsman? And, well, what happens to Pilate is a wonderful narration. And we're almost done. And I can't get it done in time. I can't. The narrator says this about her. I cannot even find it. The narration says about Pilate, remember, she's ostracized from the whole world because of this navel, or no navel. And finally, because she's been ostracized, Pilate began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, listen carefully, she threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. I assume that if I know Shakespeare and Keats and Shelley, I should have a master's degree in English. I assume I can. I assume that if you attack me, I will attack you back. Okay, I won't give you any more examples. She threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. First of all, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad? And what is the difference? What do I need to know to stay alive? What is true in the world? Remind traveled crooked streets and aimless goat paths, arriving sometimes at profundity, other times at the revelations of a three-year-old. Throughout this fresh, if common, pursuit of knowledge, one conviction crowned her efforts. Since death held no terrors for her, she often spoke to the dead, she knew there was nothing to fear. That, plus her alien's compassion. It's not normal to have this kind of compassion. Plus her alien's compassion for troubled people ripened her and, the consequence of the knowledge she had made up or acquired, kept her just barely within the boundaries of the elaborately socialized world of other people. Her dress might be outrageous to them, but her respect for other people's privacy, which they were all very intense about, was balancing. And true to the palm oil that flowed in her veins, she never had a visitor to whom she did not offer food before one word of conversation, business or social, began. She gave up, apparently, all interest in table manners or hygiene, but acquired a deep concern for and about human relationships. Of course, I'm not giving away the plot because you know this. Pilate dies. She has to. Nobody can live in this kind of gospel world. The world is too powerful. And she does. And she's dying in the arms of her nephew. And the scene is, it's still worth reading, Dan, because you know the ending. It'll make it even better because you'll look to it. You'll see it in the sense of that context. They're out to bury their father, Pilate's father, Milkman's grandfather. He's been dead a long time. They just found his bones. Should we put a rock or a cross on his grave? And, by the way, and then somebody else, it's Milkman now, who is so caught up with getting money in his life that he's going to go after Milkman because he thinks Milkman has gold now. Milkman doesn't, but Guitar doesn't know that. So that's why he's going to shoot Milkman. Okay. Should we put a rock or a cross on the grave? Pilate shook her head. She reached up. I better back up one more thing. Guitar has been watching this go on, this ceremony there over the grave that they've dug. And he's got his rifle in his hand and he's going to shoot Milkman. Should we put a rock or a cross on it? Pilate shook her head. She reached up and yanked her earring from her ear, splitting the lobe. In that earring she had her name, Pilate, and that her father gave her. Then she made a little hole with her fingers and placed in it her mother's snuff box with a single word that Jake, her father, ever wrote. She stood up then, and it seemed to Milkman that he heard the shot after she fell. He dropped to his knees and cradled her lolling head in the crook of his arm, barking at her, "You hurt? Are you hurt, Pilate?" She laughed softly, and he knew right away that she was reminded of the day he first met her and said the most stupid thing there was to say. Ah, I remember. The twilight had thickened and all around them it was getting dark. Milkman moved his hand over her chest and stomach, trying to find a place where she might be hit. "Pilate, you okay?" He couldn't make out her eyes. His hand under her head was sweating like a fountain. "Pilate," she sighed. "Watch Reba for me." And then, "I wish I'd have known more people. I'd have loved them all. If I'd have known more, I would have loved more." And the book ends. Almost. I'm not reading. She does die. Thoughts. Literature. Can it bring the gospel to us in ways that are... What's your sense of that?
Well, I kind of think the end is important to bring it back to the gospel because it's kind of the idea of miracles happening. And I guess I won't spoil it, but...
Well, she doesn't come back to life if you're thinking that, folks.
No.
Yeah. Anybody, any thoughts about all of this stuff and then the connections that you make? These are the themes you saw in the gospel. Are these themes not... And the stories of the vehicles, they carry the themes. Are these themes present in the stuff I just read? Even bigger than you kill, can you kill? You get an A. Okay, time to go. See you. Thank you.